Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Thine be the glory. Sung with some vigour at the Sydney book launch of a recently published Century of Influence, the Australian Student Christian Movement from 1896 to 1996. The book has been written by Renata Howe, who was herself a participant in some of those glorious years. Now, why the Australian Christian Movement? Well, with Prime Ministers Bob Menzies and Bob Hawke, High Court judges Sir Ronald Wilson, Sir Garfield Barwick and Doc Evatt, and educators such as David Pennington and Leonie Cramer, all as members, then it's probably a good time to reflect on the influence of a movement that coloured so much of Australian academic and university undergraduate life for 70 years. Renata Howe, welcome to Sunday Night.
It's very, very good to be here, John.
Renata, when you look at a book like yours, you're caused to say to yourself, gosh, why hasn't somebody grasped the nettle on the impact of religion on Australian cultural history before? It seems that almost there's a disservice being done here to the impact of religion in quite a significant way on Australian history and culture generally.
I think Australian historiography has really overlooked the influence of religion. And I was very conscious when I was writing the book when my fellow historians asked me, and what are you working on now? And I said, the history of the Australian student Christian movement, and a glazed look would come over their eyes. And they obviously did not think this was an important issue to be working on.
Yes, perhaps an arcane corner worthy of a monograph sometime.
That's right. And I think in Australian historiography there's been a tendency to ignore the influence of religion. It's seen as a sectarian and divisive issue in our history and not as a positive, creative issue. And that's something I certainly wish to discuss and hope that the book will challenge that view.
Well, one of the important things, and one of the first things one grasps when you begin to read, is the nature of Australian society back in the 1890s when the Australian Student Christian Movement was formed. The Student Christian Movement embodies, as much else in Australian life did at the time, a spirit of internationalism and cooperation which sort of pervaded much of the cultural life of Australia at the time. It's a time when Australia is ahead in progressive policies. You get the attitudes to women, the development of the union movement, the arbitration system. All of these are written up by historians, but the cultural factors which influence them, which quite profoundly are religious in many senses, seem to be ignored.
I think that's true. Australia is regarded as the great social laboratory of that period. And as I'm saying, these progressive Christian influence was very important in fostering that and in providing the leadership for it. And I would argue, as I have in the book, that that influence extended really right up until the post-war period. And throughout that period, the SCM was very conscious of Australia as a nation and what it wanted it to be like and of its place in the world. And it was, as Mott pointed out at the first meeting, students were inspired by a nationalism and also an internationalism.
Let's talk then specifically, just briefly, about what the SCM, the Student Christian Movement, was and how it came to be. It's founded in the 1890s, in 1896. Its inspiration flows particularly from the visit of the man you mentioned, Mott, to Australia, who happens to be an American evangelical, but an evangelical of a rather different sort than the one we'd recognise today. Tell us a little bit about Mott and what his ambitions were.
John R. Mott was a graduate of Cornell University. He was a Methodist by background, and he was very influenced by Dwight L. Moody, the famous American evangelist. And he joined the YMCA, the Young Men's Christian Association, with the specific job of setting up Christian groups on campuses. So he had the job of establishing YMCA branches on the burgeoning student colleges in America at that time.
And the YMCA of those days is rather different from the YMCA which perhaps people who grew up in the 50s and 60s and 70s recognised. The YMCA was very much an evangelistic and social organisation.
That's very true. America, in many ways, pioneered the interdenominational or non-denominational religious associations, Protestant religious associations. So you have the YMCA, the WCT, Women's Christian Temperance Union, and these organizations are really establishing an international profile towards the turn of the century. But they are very much a creation of American Protestantism in that period.
And American Protestantism comes to Australia in the form of evangelical revivalism, of which Mott is a product. But it brings to Australia a sense of revivalism which, as you indicate, is international and cross-denominationalism. And this has this begins to add an important flavour to Australia, which has been very much the province of Presbyterians in some places, Anglicans in other places, Methodists in other places.
That's true. Australia had been quite resistant in some ways to non-denominational organisations. I think I have a quote from Moody in the book, who maintained that denominations got in the way of religion. And he and Mott were very committed to non-denominational organisations as freeing Christians, as it were, to be evangelistic, to be able to witness to their faith. And that was very much the underpinning of the establishment of the World Student Christian Federation in 1895, and the Australian SCM is an outcome of that movement.
Now, this student Christian movement had very specific aims. It almost saw itself as capturing the intellectual heights in order to Christianize society in a way. That it had a deliberate focus on saying students are a critically important part of society. What we need to do is capture the hearts and minds of students.
Yes, Mott should not be seen as a typical American evangelist by any means. He was extremely strategic in his thinking. He was an excellent organiser. You should think of him more as an American businessman in many ways. But he was very strategic, and he set out to capture the elites in societies. And he saw those as the university students of the time, and that they would then be able to go out into the world and influence, take their Christianity with them. In many ways, we would now call it an ecumenical emphasis, but it was there in those days regarded as non-denominational or interdenominational.
And this is another bit that's hard for people to understand today, in that evangelicalism, this spirit of revivalism and conversion to Christ, was not simply about saving your soul for the next world. It was about radically transforming this world. There was no separation between this world and the next. Our job was to build God's kingdom here on earth. So it meant evangelicalism was often associated with the more progressive movements in society rather than the more conservative ones.
That's right. I think the word evangelical has now been captured by the more fundamentalist and conservative churches. But it should be remembered that at that time especially, it did have a much broader emphasis. And right from the start, Mott very much had mission, both social and overseas mission as a basic aim that the students and the Christian movement should adopt. It was very outward looking in that way, and mission not in the terms of conversion, but in taking the, as you say, the progressive nature of Christianity and social reform out into the world.
There's some wonderful anecdotes you share in the book, but just to give some idea of the strength and penetration of the SCM, you give us a wonderful picture of the SCM functioning in the early 1920s or late teens, early 20s in both Sydney and Melbourne in a very healthy way, and an interesting picture of two of the people who were members at that time. In Melbourne, you have Bob Menzies, the young Sir Robert, heading up the SCM's Progressive Social Engagement Service arm. And in Sydney, the exact same position in the Sydney SCM is held by one Herbert Vere Evatt, the famous doc. Here are two people who become significant figures on opposite sides of Australian politics, both concerned to express their Christianity through social engagement.
That's correct. And in the list that you read out at the start, you'll see that there's a variety of political commitments among those who were, I think, very influenced by the SCM when they were at university. And I've particularly liked that contrast between Bob Menzies, who was quite a student leader for his time in the early post-war period, post-First World War period at Melbourne University, which included being president of the SCM, and Herbert Vere Evatt, also in Sydney, who also was very active in leadership in a variety of clubs. And I should add that is a feature of the SCM. It saw itself as the leaven in the lump, so it wasn't going to be just a reclusive pietistic group. It was always focused on going out and influencing other or being involved in other clubs that shared similar ideals about the world around the university. But yes, it is a contrast between Menzies and Evatt, and several people have said to me, well, how do you identify what the influence of the SCM was if you've got two very different political viewpoints? But I think it's that commitment to putting your faith into action was very important in both those cases.
Yes, that your Christianity had to involve engagement with the world and transforming the world. You may have slightly different visions about how the world should be transformed, but it actually had to work in the world.
Yes.
Let's talk a little about the other sorts of characters that were part of that early SCM and what gave it such bite in Australian society. It's remarkable, too, reading your book, the extent to which the debates of the 1890s are very much reflected in the debates of today. One of the constraining debates that took place in those early days of SCM was the debate between science and religion. Creationism and Darwinism formed the background of many of those early debates.
That was an ongoing debate in the SCM right from the very early period. William Drummond was invited out by the SCM in the 1890s to Melbourne University, and he was one who had a very liberal view of the relationship between religion and science. He didn't see them as in conflict at all, and that was, I think, the view of the SCM right through to Charles Birch, who was, of course, the most well-known, probably, of the student Christian movement leaders in the 1950s and 60s, whose position on many of these issues was very similar to the groups in the 1890s. So there was no turning away from science, no rejecting it. It was always seen as something that you related your faith to and you worked your way through.
Charles Birch is also a symbol of much else of what SCM stood for. Charles Birch became one of Australia's most eminent scientists, yet at the same time he also became an eminent lay theologian and ultimately a recipient of the Templeton Prize for the integration of science and religion. Yet Birch also kept a lively engagement with politics as well.
Exactly. He is the epitome of the SCM in many ways. And that engagement with society was very important right throughout its history.
Our guest on Sunday night is Renata Howe, author of A Century of Influence, the Australian Student Christian Movement, 1896 to 1996. Renata, the reason I selected this is that as early as 1903, the student Christian movement were making statements about their concern of the plight of Aborigines in Australia. This is not a late discovery at all.
That is true. Quite early on, there was concern that the movement had not, while very interested in missions overseas, as inspired by Mott, had not really paid any attention to the issue of Indigenous population. Now, partly they really rejected the fairly conservative missionaries who dominated, I think, in many...
many of the
Aboriginal missions at that time. And so there was a rejection of that approach. And as time went on, I think they did develop their own empowering approach towards Aboriginal communities. And certainly Charles Dugoyd, is that how it's pronounced in South Australia, and his wife Phyllis Lade Dugoyd were very active in forming the Aboriginal protection societies of the time. And also, as time went on, of course, the movement was very influential in Aboriginal land rights in the 1960s and 70s. So there is a history there of developing an approach to Aboriginal society which was different from that of the mainline churches.
And the other remarkable thing that comes out of those early years too is the attitudes of the SCM to international relations, particularly relations with Asia. Now, this is the era of the White Australia policy, and here you have young SCM students able to go off to conferences at places around the world, particularly into Japan and then later into China in the 1920s and 1930s, times of profound disturbance in sort of racial issues for whatever reason. And here they are coming back into Australia in elite universities as young students saying, hang on, the world isn't the way we've been led to view it. And this again is an inheritance of Mott, who later in his career was approached by somebody as august as Woodrow Wilson, President of the United States, to come aboard and help Woodrow Wilson in his shaping of the League of Nations. So there's a profound internationalism going on here very early in the face of what must have been a very difficult Australian subculture.
I was very surprised myself to see how early that took place. Mott, when he came out to visit the Australian Student Christian Union, as it was then, before it was called Movement, in 1903, came out especially because he was concerned that they hadn't taken up the missionary opportunities that awaited them in Asia. And he saw the formation of the ASCM as an opportunity to witness and to be involved in the Asia-Pacific region. He felt that this was an important advantage of the Australian movement, its geographic place. Now, as we know, most people in Australia at that period thought that was their disadvantage, but Mott thought it was very much their advantage, and he saw countries, particularly Japan and China, as being very advantageous time for the movement to be influential in those countries. And he was very instrumental in holding World Student Christian Federation conferences in both Japan and China, and providing the money for some of the Australian students to attend. And they brought back with them, I mean, their influence may not have been that great in China and Japan, I discuss that in the book, but their influence back here at home was, I think, very significant in that they brought that experience back with them.
And they began to write about it and talk about it. I was struck by the remarkable way in which some of the quotations you have of these young people coming back and being profoundly influenced by Asian and African and Indian delegates at some of these meetings in a way that shifted their whole perspective of the white man's burden, as it had been phrased by Kipling, to where they began to see the Asian and African and Indian delegates as people who could teach them something. They were sitting at the feet of learned men from countries that they hadn't associated learning with.
That's very true. And they also became aware of how White Australia policy was affecting Australia's image in those countries as well, which I think was, again, not really well understood in Australia. The bitterness that there was at the colour bars that had been erected around the Pacific Rim in that period.
And their internationalism became anti-imperialist. That is, they began to develop sympathy with the movements for social change and liberation. It wasn't called liberation in those days, but certainly independence movements in some of those societies.
Yes, they were by no means traditional missionaries, and in fact there was a great deal of conflict within the missionary organisations about SCM missionaries. They went out to learn about the countries that they went to. They attempted to learn the languages and to understand the culture of those countries, and their objective was to try and build an indigenous church, and not to impose, as many missionaries tried to do, a Western imperialist type church.
Back home here in Australia, too, that began to have an impact as the SCM graduated, I guess, into political discussion in the universities, part of the cultural and social life of the universities, and was one of the agents, albeit fearfully or tentatively and with the benefit of hindsight, with horror at some people, of being an agent of the left. They were seen as being identified with progressivism, and progressivism gradually became identified with the left, and for many this was a bit of a shock and something of a disturbance, particularly in the 20s and 30s.
Yes. The 20s and 30s were very challenging decades for students, all students, and particularly those in the SCM. With the rise of communism, there was certainly quite a lot of discussion in the SCM about Christianity and communism, and there was great involvement by the SCM in the labour clubs. In fact, SCM has helped form the labour clubs at both Melbourne and Sydney universities in the 1920s. It's very interesting to read of the seriousness with which they took their Christianity and of the challenge that they saw coming from communism. And there were some who later on became members of the Communist Party, but certainly there was a great interest in relating Christianity and communism in that period.
Our guest on Sunday night is Renata Howe, author of A Century of Influence, the Australian Student Christian Movement, 1896 to 1996. It's published by the University of New South Wales Press. Renata Howe, that sense of fellowship was fractured not just by the debates between right and left that emerged in the 20s and 30s, but also a split that emerged within Christianity, particularly evangelical Christianity in the 20s and 30s, between conservatism and liberalism. And in some ways, this is also a reflection of Australian culture, the continuing tensions between Sydney and Melbourne that went back as far as pre-Federation, when the Melbourne was home of the protectionists and Sydney the home of the free traders. And this shows up again in the 30s when liberalism begins to take hold and conservative Christians began to split and debates began to emerge in the student Christian movement about orthodoxy.
Yes, there's up until the 1930s, the student Christian movement, Australian student Christian movement, was the only Christian group represented on Australian campuses, because there was such resistance to having a Christian group at all, and I do trace those struggles in the early years, but they had by that stage achieved some recognition and acceptance on the campus. And then, of course, there was the challenge from the growth of fundamentalism in the 1920s, and that was became a very great tension within the movement, and eventually resulting in the formation of the Evangelical Union in a formal way in 1930.
And the Evangelical Unions represented a more conservative, inward-looking approach to Christianity, that is, a more devotionally centred Christianity.
That's right, and also rejected the social approach of the ASCM.
Now, there is a way in which this reflected the Sydney-Melbourne divide too. Melbourne, as I said, home of the warm-hearted Methodists keen on community, and Sydney, the home of the more dogmatic evangelicals concerned with the right belief.
That's right. It's interesting to look at it. The universities in each state, and to see the different religious climate in which the SCM had to operate. And certainly at Sydney, there was always much greater tension between the student Christian movement and the Evangelical Union. And as time went on, the Evangelical Union was a larger group than the Christian Union. But the Sydney group had very much to operate within the context of the Anglican diocese in Sydney and its conservative nature.
And one of the key players at this point in time in the Sydney student Christian movement was another figure who became significant in Australian history, Sir Garfield Barwick.
That's right. He was secretary of the student Christian movement at Sydney University. He was very influenced by Samuel Angus, the Reverend Samuel Angus, who was professor of systematic theology at St Andrew's College for the Presbyterian Church. And Angus was very involved in the debates with the evangelicals on the Sydney campus, and Garfield Barwick was a very active member of the group at that time.
And it was also a time of a two-sided debate, because they were on one side dealing with the split with the evangelicals, and on the other side the debate with the emergence of the fundamentalist atheists in Sydney under the Andersonians. And
this is a very famous
debate in 1931, I believe.
That's right. The Sydney group always felt that the Melbourne group didn't understand the strength of the opposition that they had to face on the Sydney University campus, because they had Francis Anderson, who headed the Free Thought Society and wanted to ban any religious meetings on the campus as being quite opposed to a university tradition of free thought. And plus they had the very conservative Evangelical Union as well. So they felt that perhaps the Melbourne people didn't understand their problems.
Yes, and is it any wonder then that the SCM adjourned its headquarters around that time from Sydney to Melbourne?
Yes, that's quite interesting. John R. Mott had been, on his first visit in 1896, had been most impressed by Sydney, where the YMCA was stronger and there was, as we are commenting, a much stronger evangelical tradition. And he felt that Sydney would be the centre for the student Christian movement. What he failed to see was the strength of progressive theology in Melbourne, and which was based very much in the colleges around Melbourne University, where the Presbyterians, Methodists and Anglicans all had progressive theological teachers who cooperated somewhat in developing their views and inspiring students. And they were the backbone of the SCM in Melbourne, and eventually that prevailed over Sydney.
There's another aspect here of these culture wars, which in some ways is a reflection of the history wars of today. That is, the once you unpick the details of these things, it's not all black armband or white armband. That in fact, part of this does reflect sort of historic divisions in the church and in society generally. Melbourne seems much more concerned with that connection with the wider world, and Sydney with basically right belief. So the sort of the dogmatic tradition appears in sort of Labor politics in New South Wales, and that sort of broad communitarian tradition is more dominant in Victoria. It seems that it's not just in the churches.
I think that's correct. There is very much different traditions in the two cities. And if you look at Melbourne, progressive Protestantism, I'll call it for want of a better word, has always been a very significant influence in the city, and taking it right up to the 1960s, where you had a lot of very active clergy in Melbourne, very involved in many movements for social reform. There's been that tradition right through in Melbourne, whereas Sydney has had a rather different tradition in that way.
And we can't leave that period of discussion without talking about two very significant elements in the 1930s, one, or the 1920s and 30s. One was the visit to Australia by the famous British preacher William Temple, and the other is the influence of a famous Australian, and that is Ernest Bergman. And Bergman became a significant figure in the SCM, holding it through in many of those discussions in Sydney right through the 30s.
That's very, very true. William Temple did influence Bergman very considerably, and Bergman became a very dominant leader in the SCM. And I think I have a quote in the book which says his gravelly voice, it sounds as though it might have been a bit like Chifley's, can be remembered by everyone at the national conferences. The national conferences were held mainly between Adelaide, Melbourne and Sydney every year. They were open to all members of the university and to those outside. So they really became a centre for both progressive religious and political thinking. And I do argue in the book that Bergman really developed, a very progressive Christianity, which flowered in the 1940s, which saw the intervention of the state as being important, and I think a very Australian theological position, which he also developed not only through speaking but through the publication of some of the SCM study books.
And those study books became extraordinarily influential across Australian society generally because, as you say, the annual conferences of the SCM, if you read through them and the people who attended, it's almost like a who's who of Australian intellectual life of the era, from people like, you mentioned, people like Russell Ward and Vincent Buckley and A.G.L. Shaw. It's as if the SCM was seen as a place, a hothouse of ideas, where even if you weren't Christian or necessarily associated intensely with Christianity, you still wanted to be part of a vigorous discussion about the meaning and purpose of society.
That was what the SCM conferences provided. And you have to realise that there was very little opportunity for intellectuals to get together at a national level, really until after the Second World War. So these conferences became very important areas of discussion, and they're probably a main contribution of the SCM. And I should also emphasise that they gave an opportunity for women to develop their views and their theological views and social views and express them to be leaders in study groups. And they were very, very active in the national conferences. And that was an important venue also for women students and women leaders to develop their potential.
Yes, you have a very interesting description of the tension felt, almost the shock felt by some when women were seen to be actually leading worship. And this is something that couldn't happen in churches in Australia at the time, or certainly most churches. And here they were in the SCM able to do this. I guess this is another reason for the resistance in Sydney to the SCM.
Yes, the SEM provided that opportunity for women to be leaders in worship, which they didn't have in other places. It brings home to you the fact that women were so excluded from the churches and denominations at that time. And I remember Gough Whitlam commenting to me at a Bergman lecture, as a matter of fact, when they used to be held, that his sister Frieda, who became principal of Presbyterian Ladies' College, would have, and was a leader in the SCM, would have gone on to be ordained in the church if that had been a possibility at that time. So women were excluded, but within the SCM, they had an opportunity to develop some of their commitments in terms of leadership and theological ideas, etc.
Let's talk now about some of those broader contributions, the SCM. What was remarkable to me in reading the book was the role that SCM, the Student Christian Movement, had in shaping the very nature of the Australian university as it developed. And I just name a couple of things. For example, the emergence of the student union buildings out of the old college system. The SCM played an important part in the debates that established those first union buildings rather than money going into the old colleges.
That's right. I was surprised myself to discover this in my research, but they were very committed to the union buildings and were leaders, usually presidents of the union and secretaries of the union and part of the union board for a long period of time. And it was because the Australian universities, as we know, mainly students coming in from the suburbs, 9 to 5. And, of course, there was no equivalent of the college where they could have lunch, where they could interact and so on. And therefore, the SCM threw itself into establishing unions and developing unions. And I often think at the time when student unions were so much under attack in the Howard years, that some of the history of those unions I should have really brought to the fore, because they were really meant to be important centres for Australian students who were not, as they were in Britain and America, living in denominational colleges.
And there is also, of course, just moving on from the universities, the role in which the SCM played in what could be called the emerging ecumenical culture in Australia, which, even though it had its foundations in the 1890s with the early debates on ecumenism, really became centred on the intellectual life of the SCM and also into the foundation of the Uniting Church, which was a sort of practical demonstration of ecumenism. This is an extraordinary result coming out of a small campus group.
It is surprising. The Melbourne College of Divinity, which was formed in 1910, I'm told is one of the first ecumenical theological colleges in the world. I don't know if it can really claim that, but it did grant degrees in theology, and it was a representative of the Presbyterian, Methodist, Congregational, and later Anglican churches. And so it was quite a trailblazer. Then later on, through their experience of the World Student Christian Federation, the SCM in Australia were very strong supporters of the ecumenical movement. And most of the office bearers from the Australian Council of Churches and all their affiliated organisations in the early years came from the SCM.
And eventually, of course, into the Uniting Church, a profound influence there too.
That's right, which is one of the Uniting Church, Geraldine Doogue's program on that, I think last year or the year before, did show that the Uniting Church is really an Australian church. It perhaps hasn't fulfilled its the promise and hope that people had at the time, but it is perhaps our only Indigenous church in a way. But certainly the SCM in its thinking about this, as I have recently, the SCM in its history, I think, shows that an ecumenical movement freed from denominationalism can be very creative and is free to act in a way that the denominations aren't.
And that influence on the political culture of Australia remained even into most recent contemporary era. We think of names like your own husband, Brian Howe, and yourself, members of the SCM, and Brian, Deputy Prime Minister of Australia. Bob Hawke, a treasurer of the SCM branch in Western Australia. Sir Ronald Wilson, Justice of the High Court and President of the Uniting Church. All of those shaped quite profoundly by that world-engaging Christianity that the SCM consistently presented.
Yes, that's certainly that's very true. The influence of the SCM in the Canberra Public Service and in federal politics, I think, has been very significant. Bringing in, and I think that call to service, as I've emphasised in the book, I think there's a quote from Russell Ward himself that said that he can remember that he was imbued with the idea that you didn't choose a profession for money, you chose it for the opportunity for service through the SCM. Mm. And that was very evident in those who went on into the public service and politics.
Bob Hawke famously quotes an incident where he was on an SCM delegation to India, and he came out of the hotel where they were staying one night and he saw the abject poverty in the streets, and he said, this didn't match up. Here I was with this bunch of Christians in a sort of upper middle class milieu, and there was absolute poverty on the streets, and he felt a jar between what he was doing as a Christian and what the real needs of the street were. And he said that began to move him away from Christianity. And in some ways, was that not a bellwether? It marked the beginnings of a secular humanism that in some ways the SCM helped create in Australian political culture. That is, you no longer needed the church to underpin your humanist commitment to the world.
Yes, that of course was always the EU argument against the student Christian movement. I've called one of the sections, the SCM is going to hell. And that movement towards moving away from the church and from specific Christian beliefs was a very big argument in the 1960s. And that really, in many ways, as you say, started to be period where the SCM stopped being such an influential the numbers started to drop in that period.
It's something of a paradox, isn't it, that here we are at the end of a century of influence, and we have in the world at the moment probably, maybe it's just a unique moment where you have leaders of our three or four major democracies all saying they have explicit Christian commitments which have flowed out of their student days. I mean, Tony Blair in England, succeeded by Gordon Brown, a child of the manse. You then have Kevin Rudd in Australia, explicitly a Christian in his commitment. Before him, the leader of the Labor Party, Kim Beazley, again, explicit in his commitment. And Barack Obama, a man who, along with Bishop Bergman of the 30s, shares a theological commitment to the thought of Reinhold Niebuhr. Yet none of these, that contemporary group, seem to trace their links back to SCM.
Yes, I think it is interesting, though I haven't checked with Kevin Rudd. I have spoken with Therese, and she says, I think she did indicate that they may have attended some SCM meetings and so on when they were students at the ANU in the 1980s, but I haven't followed that through with them personally to a great extent. But certainly the theology of the SCM has very much coming to the fore at the moment, as you say, with political leaders, which is very interesting. Rudd is very much a follower or a reader of Reinhold Niebuhr, and his ideas very much reflect the Niebuhr's ideas that were so influential in the SCM in the 30s and 40s. And, of course, Rudd himself started his run for the prime ministership with his lecture, which Brian and I attended, on Bonhoeffer, which was given to a Uniting Church group, and, of course, then wrote that up as an essay. So, certainly, again, with the British Labour Party, there seems to be that SCM progressive religious influence that I think that commitment to trying to turn your faith into action, which was always the objective of the SCM.
Renata Howe, a quite wonderful and prescient book, and I do thank you for the extensive index and footnotes too, for any interested in following up many of the strands that Renata opens up. This book is a wonderful resource. Renata Howe, it's been great to have you with us on Sunday night. And we should finish with one of those songs that reflects that that great era of progressivism, the 1960s, when so much of what SCM was fighting for in the civil rights movement in the United States, the land rights movement here in Australia and other things came to be. We Shall Overcome. Renata Howe, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John.
We shall
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/Sunday Nights with an S. Thank you for listening.